Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Devinder Hardwar.
And Dwayne DeFreitas should be joining us momentarily. He's en route, running a little late. And Christopher Bernor is flying in an airplane back from South by Southwest. So he won't be joining us this week. But
although it'd be funny if somebody could at some point podcast from a plane. I'm sure everybody else on the plane would appreciate that.
That would be awesome. I don't know how it would be. It would be very expensive, I would imagine.
No, it's just Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi.
If you can get the Wi-Fi, yeah.
Right. We are coming to you live on geeksofdoom.com. And this week on the show, we talk about a controversial new lawsuit that pits Yahoo against Facebook and a new suggested code for sharing on the internet. But first, occasionally on the show, we like to do a segment called What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, games, and tech that has obsessed us in the past week. And this week, I want to talk about a game that I discovered and have been literally obsessed with on a regular basis. And that is Draw Something, which is an app for iOS.
Mm-hmm. And and many other people, Andy. Yeah.
Apparently, it's a bit of a hit. It's just a few days old, like 2 weeks old, and it's been downloaded more than 1.2 million times, according to a report in Business Insider. And in just 5 weeks, the game has been downloaded 20 million times. That's more users than Foursquare. That's almost as many users as Instagram. It's one of the fastest growing mobile apps of all time, and it's pretty basic. It's basically like Pictionary. Like I like to think of it as Pictionary with friends. Compare it to some of the Zynga apps. Users connect to people on Facebook. They're given three words, and they can choose one to draw. And then the image is sent to a friend who guesses what that word is. And I'm pretty hooked. Have you had a chance to play with this? Have you played with this at all, Devinder?
No, I haven't had a chance. I've seen a lot of people I know who've been getting hooked on it, mm-hmm. but it's only a two-player game, right? So you have to team up with somebody and do the Words with Friends thing, do the Pictionary game. I just haven't found the time, and all my time has been spent on Mass Effect 3. Any free time that I have.
Oh, I do want to hear about that. Oh, you told mm-hmm. us a little bit about that last week.
I did. It continues to be amazing. So it's just one of those games that I'm totally wrapped into.
The good thing about this Draw Something is, it basically, first of all, it looks through your Facebook contacts, and then you can choose to connect with somebody on Facebook that you know. But even if you don't know somebody, you can just start a random game with some random person on Facebook, and I've started a few of those random games, and they're incredibly fun. And how they make their money is I don't know if they have a free and a paid version. I think I just paid for the paid version, so they must have a free and a paid version.
Okay.
And the paid version has got to be like without ads. I'm sure that's the part of that business model, but the other part is you can pay for credits to have the opportunity to remove letters from the pool of letters that you can guess the word from. This is an interesting one. You can pay to add extra colors to your palette of to draw with, so you're not just drawing with basically black. And that really helped me out the other day when I was trying to draw broccoli, and I needed green basically. I can foresee, like, I can extrapolate from there other things that they can add in that you can pay for, like extra line widths or the ability to fill, use a fill tool. I would pay for that in this game. Because a lot of times I'm grabbing a really thick line width and just... I have fat fingers, so...
You know what you need, Andy? You need a stylus.
Yes, well, what I'm...
A Samsung.
What I'm looking forward to is being able to play this on my new iPad when it arrives this week.
Uh-huh.
How's that for a segue?
That should be fun, for sure, yeah.
So, according to segueing into our headlines from there, the news is in and pre-orders are for the new iPad are off the charts.
Shocking.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes. Yeah. It's according to Apple, the pre-orders have sold out for arrival on March 16th. And if you order the new iPad now, you're going to have to wait for at least March 19th as the earliest ship date, perhaps even later. I mean, it's probably
later. I pre-ordered last Friday.
Uh-huh.
And I think I have like a March 22nd or 23rd ship date. So it took me, I'm getting it for work to actually do a review because Apple, we're not on the cool kids list. So I took them a long time to tell me, okay, buy it. So, oh well.
It is going to be exciting. There's a couple things we were talking about just before the show that we didn't really cover when we did our initial overview of the iPad. And one of them is that because of the higher resolution screen, the apps are actually going to be chunkier in size. The file sizes of those apps mm-hmm. are going to be bigger, which is going to come as kind of a shock to people who own earlier versions of the iPad.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if people will necessarily notice, but they will see that, you know, maybe they'll have a lot less free space by downloading apps without putting too much media on the iPad.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait for mine to come. Should be coming sometime this week, so looking forward to it. And,
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what that means for comics and, you know, for really good art, too.
Oh, yeah.
There's the potential for like some really fine art apps as well to like that have high resolution scan of things, because just viewing it on that screen would be so much better than anything we've ever had before.
Yeah, yeah. The iPhoto, the new iPhoto app on the iPad looks terrific. Looks mm-hmm. just amazing. And Camera Plus just updated their app to work with the new iPad as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I am looking for a lot of these, the photo manipulation and the art stuff. And I really got to get a stylus too. Cause...
They do make them. They make styluses that work on capacitive screens. So maybe those will become more of a thing now that you have this really nice screen to play with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe Apple will make one. That'd be amazing.
That would be interesting. I saw also, one on yeah. Kickstarter that was magnetic and attaches to the side of the iPad that has the magnets on it.
That'd be great, yeah.
I'm sorry, you were saying...
Yeah, I was saying that would be great. That's all.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on here. Instagram founder Kevin Systrom demonstrated an Android version of Instagram on stage at South by Southwest this last week during an interview. He waved it around very briefly on stage, but didn't give it a demo.
In front of the drooling crowds, you know. Yeah. This is like the new rock star stuff. You wave an app in front of yeah. a horde of people.
there really isn't much to say about that news report.
Yeah. What's funny is that I've... for various news, Instagram is a very small company. They only have, like, I think 6 people now. For the longest time, there were 4 people. So I've had to chat with Kevin and some of those guys a couple times. And every time, it's like, where's the Android app? Where's the Android app?
Yeah.
I'm sure he's just beaten down now by that question. So here you go. Here's the Android app. Still no idea when it's coming.
Right. No idea when it's coming, but it is coming. So that's going to yeah. Please.
He also hinted that it's better than the iPhone app for some reason.
Oh, really?
And that, I'd be interested to see what that means. Like, are they hooking into something that Android has that you don't get in iOS?
Hmm.
Yeah.
What does Android have as far as camera features that you don't
when it comes to photos? I'm not sure. That's a good question.
All right. Let's move on here. Okay. So 3 months after the acquisition of Gowalla by Facebook, the company has officially closed its doors.
I'm shocked. I'm just going to say this all night.
This was like the big competitor to Foursquare, though. This is the one that I remember when the two of them came out. It was Foursquare, and then shortly thereafter, a few months afterwards, Gowalla came out, and
they were the big South by Southwest hits, what, 2 or 3 years ago?
Yeah, so, and they were perceived to be a real threat to Foursquare for a while. They had some major investors.
I think they had shinier icons, didn't they? And they had like a slightly nicer design.
Yeah,
I never used it.
So, what happened? Was it just people stopped using it?
People only, like, what happened was a lot of other companies got into it, right? Facebook's doing check-ins, Google's doing check-ins now, and those are all on social networks that you're already using. So the hardcore people are sticking with Foursquare, or the people who care about, you know, checking in more than others, and then everybody else, like, occasionally they'll do it on Yelp or Facebook or whatever. I don't think the check-in, and even Foursquare is looking at this, the check-in is not that valuable of a thing, and it's not, I don't think it's necessarily innovative. It's just like a way to like plant your flag that you're at this place. The real question is, what are you doing beyond that? And Foursquare has already answered that with, like, they have a partnership with American Express. They're looking at all sorts of things for the future.
Yeah, I mean, I usually do Foursquare and Yelp as my main kind of check-in, location check-in places. And Yelp is mainly just, I do it just for restaurants, and Foursquare for events or places.
Mm-hmm. I think Foursquare was also better about like getting its API out and working with other apps. Like sometimes when I Instagram, I also, you know, just flip off the Foursquare thing there, and that's a check-in with the picture. So just works nicely.
Oh, I love that about, yeah, absolutely. Like when I do Instagram, it goes out to like 3 or 4 different places: Facebook, Foursquare, Tumblr, Twitter. I'm covered. I do appreciate that. I really do. I mean, I wish more apps would cross integrate.
Yeah. I'm sure like only a certain subset of users ever flip more than like 2 of those things, but it is very nice for the addicted types.
Yes. Yes. okay, let's move on here. I feel like we're going super fast.
We're good. We're efficient, you know. And I blame Dwayne because I spent a lot of the Symbiotic podcast just telling Dwayne to like move on from stories. So, you know, we're going.
We're sliding by.
For sure. We didn't mention the iPad reviews that just came out. And also, shockingly, they're pretty much all positive. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could say what you want about people like David Pogue and Walt Mossberg.
I love them. I love them both.
Yeah.
They write for different markets or different demographics than the geeky blogs and stuff.
But the general consensus is that they're in the pocket of Apple and you're going to get a good Apple review from them no matter what.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I mean, it seems to be across the board. Everyone seems to be gushing about it, and mainly about the screen. They're saying basically that high resolution Retina display is not just an upgrade to the resolution of the screen, it's also a transformative aspect of the device that makes it more than previous models.
Yeah, I mean, it's a transformative computing milestone, basically, because before, like, you know, high resolution displays have existed before for a long time. So when I was writing up the iPad stuff, somebody tweeted at me that, oh yeah, I had a 20-inch monitor that did a higher resolution than that, a decade ago, which is nice, but that's a lot more surface area. That's like not nearly as dense as the amount of pixels. And the problem with running your display like that on a computer, at least back in the CRT days, is that, you know, it got really small. Things got really hard to see. You know, so, and now that we're with LCDs, like, they've gotten bigger and we have some nicer resolutions. But even then, like, you can only go so high resolution with a typical desktop OS. Like, if you go too high on Windows or Mac OS X on a 50-inch screen, then you can't see anything.
Right.
So, it seems like iOS was really easy to scale to something much higher. And mm-hmm. that's something past OSs just have been really slow to do.
Yeah, I'm just stoked. I'm stoked about mm-hmm. about it arriving and me able to use it on a regular basis to read and watch movies, essentially, and comics. I didn't even think about really the comics until you had mentioned it earlier. Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of comics on my iPhone, and if yeah. you've ever tried to read comics on an iPhone,
that's torture.
Yeah,
that's like newspaper comic strips, you know.
Yeah, you have to do a lot of pinching and squeezing.
Yeah, but now, like, with the new iPad's display, like, you can zoom in, like, assuming they give you that level of quality in the mm-hmm. comic, but you'll be able to, like, zoom in and really get a close look at the art in ways that are, you know, just so beyond anything that we've had before. So I'm excited about that.
You know what else I'm excited about is this this new technology that Microsoft's Applied Sciences group is working on, which is a touchscreen with a super high latency.
Mm-hmm.
Average,
super low latency.
I'm sorry.
Right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Super yeah. low latency.
Like, lower is better for kids, you know.
Average touchscreens have a latency of about 100 microseconds,
mm-hmm.
which if you think, like, when you're using something like the iPad or any sort of capacitive touchscreen, you may be so used to it that you don't even really notice it, but there is like a lag when you draw yeah. things. And
yeah, that's really noticeable on things like the Samsung Galaxy Note,
uh-huh.
which, you know, when you're handwriting, that's when you really notice
yeah.
it. Because normally, pen to paper, you expect an instant response. And when we're just dragging our fingers around, it's less noticeable. Yeah, it would be nice to have some super fast displays.
Right. So they're working on that at the Applied Sciences Group at Microsoft. It's essentially it brings the latency down to 1 microsecond. And I've seen the video that has accompanied some of the articles about this.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. I mean,
he's dragging that square really fast, Andy.
Yeah.
It's really yeah. dynamic.
And you don't, and you think, and this is one of those things that you look at on paper and you're like, uh-huh. Big whoop. So 100 microseconds down to 1 microsecond, what difference could it really make? But when you see it, the video in action, and you see and you realize that something like this is really going to be transformative. You know, combine this with a Retina display, and like, there's no, you've completely replaced drawing pads.
Right. But this seems like the classic problem, right? Microsoft versus Apple. This is a nice test research demo with mm-hmm. a really ugly looking early version of this display that we probably won't see for a couple of years. Whereas Apple just, you know, they kind of got the suppliers, they got the tech out, and they were able to do the Retina display long before many people thought, you know, something like this was possible.
Well, maybe here's hoping that somewhere in an Apple lab somewhere, they're secretly stealing Microsoft's innovation there. And...
Oh, you know it. You know it. The thing about, like, what I love after every new Apple device is that, you know, different sites do, like, the deconstruction, mm-hmm. and then you find these mystery chips, and people are like, what does that do? What's going on here? I love it, like, when the Siri, when the iPhone 4S came out, there was this mystery, like, sensor at the top, and that turned out to be, like, a proximity sensor
mm-hmm.
that allowed Siri to, like, you know if you're holding up to your face or not. It's those sort of little innovations that kind of push things forward. But, like, Apple doesn't, like, make a huge deal about those things. So those are nice. They help to polish the products. Microsoft, unfortunately, they have cool research videos that we may or may not ever see, you know, come to fruition.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of a shame. Like, I love
yeah.
the fact that it kind of that they were able to develop connect mm-hmm. development out of the environment of the 360,
yes.
and that was kind of pushed by grassroots users kind of forced their hand to do that. I'm glad that they did that.
And like their innovation for the past few years has mainly been in the Xbox, because, you know, they've had a lot of momentum there. The people behind the Xbox have been really good about just like streamlining, getting new tech there, and pushing things forward in many ways. Like, so that's why I'm sort of shocked that Windows 8 is turning out to be so interesting, because Microsoft as a company seems to be like, you know, interesting ideas seem to be anathema to Microsoft at times.
Yeah, but they really are rolling with it, and I love the fact that they've opened up this consumer preview like this early. Aren't they due to release Windows 8 next year? Isn't it like a whole year ahead of?
No, it's definitely not a whole year. They haven't really talked release dates, but I like knowing Microsoft and knowing these this current game plan. I'm thinking it's more like for the end of the year, or as close to that as possible, because in past situations, like, it's good to be there before the holiday season, and also close to the beginning of the school year, because then retailers can like sell a PC that says like it's Windows 8 ready or whatever, and then you'll get a free upgrade in a couple months. That's sort of, you know, you do that right at the end of the year for the holiday season and everything.
Oh, that makes sense.
That makes more sense, yeah.
Did you ever see, it was a while back, I think last August, Wired did an article about Microsoft's research lab, and they highlighted like five or six innovations, like state-of-the-art innovations that that the labs were working on. And like any one of these innovations alone would be revolutionary in the consumer setting, and once again, like you had mentioned, these are all kind of stuck in in this research environment. Right. I don't know if you had a chance to see that article.
Yeah, I remember seeing that, and that's the sort of thing that makes me sad. And it's sort of like seeing the Courier, right? Like the Courier was this great device that I was really, really into. It could have, like, look at what Samsung's doing now with the Galaxy Note, and they're bringing that to a bigger tablet. That's essentially what Microsoft was trying to do with the Courier, but even not as interesting. And it's a damn shame, because I totally would be rocking a Courier today. And I would be taking that everywhere with me, unlike the iPad, which I don't.
Yeah, well, that Courier demo was just like, it was blue sky. It was like a dream. it was kind of like that video a few days ago. Before the iPad came out, there was a video that someone had made of a future iPad that had holographs essentially coming out of the screen. And it was just so kind of wildly out there. Now, the Courier, everything in the Courier seemed very realistic, but it still had that feel of like this would be amazing if this were actually real.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on here. So Yishan Wang, a former director of engineering at Facebook, who spent more than 4 years at Facebook overseeing ads, payments, and internationalization efforts, is becoming the chief executive of Reddit. He says, I feel like I've been called to serve. I think Reddit is a force for good in the world, and if they need someone with my skills, I'm going to step up. He was instrumental in building Facebook's engineering operations after serving more than 4 years at PayPal. Now, I think this is really surprising. Like, I am not entirely sure what a CEO of Reddit is going to do, except for maybe be like a
upvote faster, you fools.
like maybe be a liaison to corporate interests, to enterprise.
To Condé Nast.
Yeah.
I mean, Reddit is still, you know, owned by a major media company, which has shockingly been pretty hands-off with it, given all the controversy lately. So it seems like they need an adult or somebody in charge.
That's
to,
pretty
like,
much it.
Deal with that, yeah.
They want somebody to help mind the kids while they're... And hopefully maybe keep things from their recent embarrassment over subreddits that feature underage children out of, I mean, I can see where that would definitely be one of the situations that they would need somebody to come in and squash that immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's a, it's kind of shocking too, that Reddit is exploding in a, you know, in popularity as it still is. Just because, like I remember back when Dig was the one really big, you know, user base. I'm sure you remember this, Andy. It seemed Reddit was sort of the underdog, this cool little thing, the smaller community of people who just like they enjoyed upvoting stories and having their really dorky conversations. And now Reddit is the titan.
It is my opinion, my confirmed opinion, that if Dig hadn't come out with that horrible version 4 that the entire community rejected, Reddit would still be that underdog. It's like an environment where you have these wild cats, and the wild cats are domesticated. And then suddenly you have what ends up being evolving into what ends up being a house cat. I mean, it's kind of the opposite direction. Without the predator, without the Dig as the predatory force in that environment, Reddit has become this, evolved into this dominant species.
Yeah, I could see that. The internet predators for your upvotes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Reddit has won. I'm looking at Compete right now for Dig, and you know, these stats aren't always accurate, but it looks like from a year ago, Dig's been down from 5 million uniques a month to less than 3 million. It's going downhill from here, guys.
Where does that compare?
Compete.com.
But how does that compete to Reddit?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me do that right now. But yeah, it's just weird because I remember a couple of years ago, Reddit now is still slightly fewer visitors. Well, according to Compete, it's been up from 2 million a year ago to around 2.7, 2.6 now.
Interesting.
So I think it's like it's a group of people who are highly engaged and who are like driving traffic as well. Yeah, better than Dig used to.
Do you think that the average internet surfer is still unaware of social networks like Dig and Reddit?
Oh yeah, these are specialized little things. Like the internet, like when I first joined, you'd go, when I was on AOL or just bumming around IRC, you'd find little rooms and you'd make friends there, and it becomes a little community. And these are, you know, Reddit's a community on the web, and it's just tough for people to find it. And most people just stick with Facebook, and then they find the funny pictures or links occasionally.
I feel like if you're just jumping onto the internet today, that you will never know Dig or Reddit, and you'll just stick with, like, Twitter and Facebook and other sites like Tumblr.
It depends. It seems like you either use what your friends use or something like that. Like Reddit is still a social network. It's a social news network. Yeah. But you know, it really depends. With more people coming online, I think of course more people would be going to Reddit, but I have no idea the perspective of somebody who's grown up in a world where the internet has always existed. I don't know what that world is like. Seriously.
Neither do I.
Yeah. That's just, I can't even comprehend that right now. Like I'm talking to kids now, who are like, you know, not very old, so it's like they just know this stuff. Like they know that the internet exists, and then kids who are growing up with touch screens. Like I think that's the next big generation, right?
Right.
The people
who
are just used to touching all these devices.
Yep.
Forget the console, forget the keyboard and mouse. Anyway.
I can't be unbiased either, because I come from a world where I was around before. Well, not I was around before Dig and Reddit, but I was also around before I jumped into social media before Twitter, before Facebook really took off, before Tumblr or any of the other social networks that are currently dominating. So to me, I know. I really don't know. I've like Dig and Reddit are my norm, and mm-hmm. Twitter and Facebook are the outliers for me, even though they're the more popular.
Indeed, you should spend a little more time on Twitter, Andy. I think it could really help you out.
Well, yeah, you're probably right.
If you're going to spend time on one of them, just spend a little time on Twitter. Also, because the conversation is so much more interesting.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, I am doing quite well on Reddit.
Yes, I know.
All right. Okay, this one's an interesting one. CNN and Mashable are in advanced talks that may lead to an acquisition of the site, according to people briefed on the talks.
Wasn't that supposed to happen already, though? It was supposed to be announced today or something.
I had not heard any of that, unless that's new news.
No, I thought that was the assumption from the reports, that it was, or that was one of the things being reported.
Oh, the talks were going to happen today?
On Wednesday or something, but maybe all these this news that leaked out has pushed the announcement or something. I don't know. Like, I was actually talking with my editor, AdventureBeat, about this.
Uh-huh.
You know, he wasn't quite sure about what Mashable could offer to CNN, but, I mean, you definitely would understand this, Andy. Like, Mashable, of all the new media sites, or, you know, the popular blogs, they've sort of mastered social. Like, they've mastered the idea of just getting your readers to do half of the work for you,
mm-hmm.
and then letting them drive traffic. So, yeah, you apply that to CNN stories, that could be huge for them.
You would say more than, say, TechCrunch?
In terms of getting people to do their bidding? Yeah, yeah. Like, TechCrunch, like, they're popular because, you know, their stories get promoted a lot, and they have a really, they're the go-to site among techies.
Uh-huh.
But Mashable just seems like they've attracted, I don't know if it's through bots or through what, but they've definitely attracted, like, a huge bump of, you know, social media for pretty much all of their stories. And then you look at their stuff, like, after a few days, after a post is up, and you'll see thousands of retweets and thousands of Facebook likes. That's something, like, sites like VentureBeat, we mm-hmm. rarely see something like that.
Hmm.
Yeah. There's something, like, there is something going on there, it, just in terms of how stories are shared. I also think, like, as a site, they kind of just started targeting the lowest common denominator for page views and for slideshows and all that stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they've done a lot of work. They've laid a lot of groundwork in getting and really kind of connecting with people mm-hmm. in real life, too. Because I see a Mashable presence anywhere that I go. Like,
They also have a ton of money. Like, they have like some sort of like a mini conference every year. I don't know if it's a conference. It's just like an event uh-huh. in New York where they, you know, they have people come and. I forget what it's called typically, but it's a really spiffy sort of thing. Like, it's a spiffy event, and they definitely have more money than other sites I've seen holding similar events. So, yeah, it's kind of crazy. And no funding. Like, they haven't been, you know, hitting up VCs for funding. This is all money that Mashable has made itself. That's what's most impressive, I think.
Do you think if CNN were to acquire Mashable, that it would go the way that TechCrunch did when Huffington Post acquired them?
I don't know. Like, I don't know CNN's traffic situation. Uh-huh. I don't know how it's going to work out. But the thing is, like, the TechCrunch AOL thing was all about egos.
Yes.
You had big swinging dicks just, like, getting into conflict. And so CNN doesn't have that problem. Mashable doesn't necessarily have that issue.
Pete Cashmore doesn't have a big swinging dick?
That I don't know. I don't know the guy. He seems nice, but he's definitely not somebody online who's causing controversy.
Mm-hmm.
He's more like the guy that wants to be everybody's friend, because then you will share his stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that just seems to be like that. That was Mashable's tactic, and now it seems to finally be paying off.
That's actually very. I've met Pete. That's actually a very apt assessment.
Yeah, like, I've never seen him say a bad word about anybody. There doesn't seem to be any drama. It's just nice, fun. But where do you meet him?
At events. Like I said, the Mashable makes itself present at a lot of social media events, and I've met him. And one of the former chief editors, Ben. I can't remember.
Ben Parr.
Ben Parr. Yes.
Yeah.
Who's also a nice guy too, and very, mm-hmm. very, very savvy himself.
Got a little screwed over there.
Yeah.
But, oh, well.
Speaking of social networks, Posterous, a blogging platform that embodies Tumblr's simplicity, if not its stylishness.
Is it Posterous or Posterous? I could never tell.
I don't know. You know what? I'll go with Posterous. Cause...
All I know is that it's ugly and I never used it. So.
I have to admit that I am not a Posterous user.
It's so ugly. Myself. Why would you use that when you have Tumblr right there?
But they've been acquired by Twitter. So, I mean, what are they? What does Twitter want with something that, quote unquote, ugly to use?
It seems like the beginning, like they couldn't buy Tumblr because Tumblr is a super popular company.
Yep.
It's valued very high. It would be a really expensive buy. So it's actually much easier to buy like a second tier company. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know if it's second tier compared to Tumblr, but I know it's a lot less popular. So it's easier to buy something like this and let that be an easy way to, like, I don't know, maybe this could lead to like slightly longer form things for Twitter, or at least the way I see it, like, maybe they could be taking a sort of angle to Tumblr, or at least letting you customize your Twitter page with a lot more stuff rather than just your feed.
Do you feel that kind of engagement that goes on at Tumblr is attractive to Twitter?
Oh, for sure. Like, it's an interesting engagement. Like, Twitter has much of that as well. But Tumblr, because it's long form, because you can do so much more with it, and it's such like a customizable platform that, it opens the door for all sorts of things. Like, some people's websites are just their Tumblrs, but nobody's website can just be their Twitter. And that's a problem.
Right. I do appreciate the kind of the feel of Twitter and compared to I'm sorry, the feel of Tumblr compared to Twitter, because it does allow it gives two things that I don't really get from Twitter that I don't feel like I get from Twitter is, first of all, long form for sure. A broader variety of ways of content to share on the site, like music and video and
pictures. Like, it's really all about pictures.
Yeah.
That's what's been pushing Tumblr. That's what's really pushed Pinterest as well. Like, people love pictures on the web, and I guess having new and fun ways to share them. You look at Instagram, that seems to be the key to all these super successful new properties.
Yep. Okay. I think, are you on, Dwayne? Or have you joined us?
I am, yeah.
All right.
How's it going, guys?
We welcome Dwayne DeFreitas, our other member here on the show. You're just in time, Dwayne, for our last headline before we get into our Audible spot and our hot topic. And the last headline's kind of a sad, nostalgic one. After 244 years, the Encyclopedia Britannica is going out of print. In acknowledgement of the realities of the digital age and competition from Wikipedia, Encyclopedia Britannica will focus primarily on its online encyclopedias and educational curriculum for schools. The last print version is a 32-volume 2010 edition, which weighs 129 pounds. And includes entries on global warming and the Human Genome Project. I remember back in the day before the internet, back in my day, it was the Encyclopedia Britannica.
It's still your day.
It is still my day. But I'm talking about a day that many people listening will have never known. And that is the days of the Encyclopedia Britannica and the World Book. I don't know if anybody remembers the World Book.
The World Book Encyclopedia. And then there was Childcraft for the kids. Childcraft Encyclopedia.
There was all sorts of stuff. Like, there was a Charlie Brown one. Like, they were all different branded encyclopedias.
Branded encyclopedias, yeah.
That's the Charlie Brown one is actually the one my parents ended up getting at some point. And that not only made me fall in love with Charlie Brown, but made me fall in love with, like, facts and science.
Mm-hmm.
So those things did work.
Yeah, absolutely. I had this one called, we had a Britannica. We had the 1979 Britannica in my house that I think my dad insisted he'd get. And that was great. But we had this one called Childcraft, and they were like numbered edition. They were like numbered volumes, 1 through like 20. And then there was a dictionary, and then there was like some special editions, whatever. And it was really focused on, they were thin, maybe 150 pages each. And, you know, they were focused on like animals, plants, this, that. So there wasn't a straight alphabetical. But that encyclopedia, the way it was organized, was perfect for kids. Because I just remember the images were all in full color. The words were not esoteric or strange. And I love that thing. And then it helped me graduate into the Britannica that we had there. And that was pretty, it was just a wonderful experience. Like I loved, it made me love reading more than anything. So, but this guy, Jorge Caos, the company's president, he told the New York Times that it's a rite of passage in a new era. People will feel sad and nostalgic about it, but, you know, we have, it's in from, I mean, he's obviously, he's got to position his place in the market. He's got to be, selling somewhat, but he literally says, but we have a better tool now. The website is continuously updated and it's much more expansive and it has multimedia. So the encyclopedia that you're getting for the subscription or however they based their service today, they believe is the better way to do it. So it's not a question of them just kind of going away. The print edition isn't there. There are 4,000 copies left at a price of $1,375 each.
It's pricey.
US. Yeah. So it's kind of like an upper middle class thing to get a set of books that you won't really use and it doesn't really get updated. Books. And they acknowledge that with the Wikipedia, you know, they have more content on the Wikipedia, but they are focused on the fact that their content is their content is scientifically accurate, and that they don't they kind of leave the Wikipedia for the actress's movie lie the movie actress's like social lives and all the stuff you can get on TV and certain characters and everything like that, and they're focused more on a sort of hard sciencey and another like life nature kind of taxonomic.
Yeah, no, and sure. I mean with Wikipedia too. Like, you don't have to pay them $70 a year. So, you know, how much? I think it's $70 a year, right, for the digital edition.
Yeah, it's about $70 a year, and then it's also and in 2005, I remember Devinger and I, we talked about this amongst ourselves when this happened. There was a study that came out that said, you know, in the average Wikipedia article, like they went toe to toe Wikipedia or Britannica, and it was like four mistakes in averaged in the articles that they'd chosen. You know, and it was you know, snails versus snails, you know, apples to apples, one to another. So there'd be four mistakes in the Wikipedia version and possibly three mistakes in the Britannica version. Now, Britannica says that the study was a wash. It didn't really, like, it wasn't really an accurately done study. But that definitely gave credence to the idea that this experiment, this Wikipedia, the fact that social media could beat traditional print media.
Yeah, that's
for a knowledge
huge.
Base. That's that's kind of huge. Like that. So you think of social media as, like, such junk, but the Wikipedia is an example of social media that I think has made the world a better place.
It's self-correcting, which is something
like
that
like an organism,
exactly.
You know, which is it's information that's alive, and I think that's the key. Like I do remember that study, Dwayne, and to me that was the moment when Britannica died, because if you're getting better information, you're getting more accurate information from Wikipedia and for free. There's no question, like
or at least as accurate information, right?
Like sure.
As long as it's as accurate or as close to accurate, and let's face it, the Wikipedia is not the prime. If you want to know something about it, the Wikipedia, just like the encyclopedia before it, is not the primary source. You go to the Wikipedia to get a general understanding. Mm-hmm. You begin to look at the Wikipedia's references, and if it's a good article, which many are, there are numerous references that you could go and like reach out to. Many of them are books, not just links around the web. Mm-hmm. So. That's definitely huge. And then there's just the idea that the Wikipedia, oftentimes you'll hear, well, not oftentimes, every once in a while, you'll hear some politician or some focus group or some, like, you know, hard right or hard left group change the article on the Wikipedia to reflect its viewpoint or something. And that comes out, and just like Andy said, it corrects itself. The world kind of like leans on that until like social pressure pulls it closer to the middle. And they've done great things with making sure that, you know, we think this article, it's out here, but we think that it has some bias. It's out here, but it needs more source information. It's out here, but it has this problem. Right. So they have these disclosures that let you know what you're getting and what it means.
Yeah. You know what's funny? Like, all of Britannica's comments basically were like, we're not dead yet. You know, they cut off our arms, they cut off our legs, but we're still going. No, they're not gonna survive. That digital edition. I think I was reading some really good reporting about how Britannica failed, and somebody mentioned, I think it was Harry McCracken, who's now writing at Time, and Techland is over there now too. He was talking about how like they failed to join up with Microsoft when Encarta was a big thing.
Yeah.
Honestly, for me, Encarta was a big part of my 90s and was how that, I used a lot of
multimedia. And Carter was the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like, and it was on a CD, yeah. whatever. Just yeah. like Microsoft.
Everything was on a CD at that point. So.
Yeah, but it was the first, like, it was, that was when I think, and you know, you guys might like, chide me for this, but I feel like that reminds me of when the word interactive really meant something.
Sure.
Yeah.
A lot of times I hear the word. Yeah, exactly. And I hear the word interactive today. And like with the encyclopedia that Microsoft had, you couldn't like necessarily write in it. I think you could take notes or something, but it was like they had some images, they had some video, they had some other stuff. Your computer would crank to run that at like 200 megahertz or whatever. But it was
poor
good
little
stuff.
386 and 486, yeah.
Exactly. So then you get to this point where you know, you see some of the stuff online, and then the Wikipedia takes interactive to a whole new level because now you can apply your knowledge. And in my case, whenever I edited the Wikipedia, it wasn't because I knew some topic better than some expert, but I would like find grammar mistakes that I would be fixing. Like, let's just like shore this up. Like, I know grammar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like whatever contribution you could make, you'd make.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. So. It's kind of, I mean, it's sad to write a passage, but I mean, it's like vinyl. It's like, it's like celluloid film. I mean, it's just another innovation that is going through a transition that will be a thing of the past.
Sounds to me it's more like a mini disc. Remember that?
Yeah,
we'll say that in 10 years. Remember Britannica?
Well, I think it's a little different because mini disc was kind of a fad.
Yeah, yeah,
I know.
Britannica has been around for a couple hundred years, and they've had issues. Yeah. They suffered a bankruptcy. I think it was in earlier last century or something. So it's an ongoing and long going organization.
Yep.
But you know what? They failed to adapt to the digital world, and this is what happens. Mm-hmm.
They think they're adapting to the digital world is the problem. I think they haven't quite realized that on some level they failed.
Right.
You know?
Like, oh yeah, for sure. So like I don't know, like maybe we should create a new Darwin's law here because on the internet it's the free and open survive. And that's generally how things are going.
That's actually a great point. I mean, that's a great kind of takeaway from this.
I don't know if that's always the case, though, because I think, and Andy, I think you could agree with me that there are a bunch of wonderful free services that oftentimes disappear, can't fund themselves, get bought and get destroyed. And I think the Wikipedia is actually an example of something that is at a delicate balance because, you know, you get to the Wikipedia for half the year and Jimmy Wales or some other users up there.
Right.
And they're asking you to pay money, and I pay money. I treat it like NPR. I pay it when I can. Okay. But I know that the vast majority of the people aren't paying it because they're like, oh, whatever, it's not really going away, or whatever. And then when it's finally in trouble, it's almost too late oftentimes. So I feel like the thing about the Wikipedia at $70 – I mean the Encyclopedia Britannica at $70 a year, it's expensive compared to the Wikipedia. You're not getting as much compared to the Wikipedia. You might be getting more quote-unquote accurate stuff, but you know, on some level, you don't care as much because of what you're losing. But if they can maintain that model, if they can maintain users for that model, whether it's schools, and I know that a lot of what they do is partner with institutions and partner with businesses and partner with other things, and that's where their bread and butter is coming from, not the individual user. That might be a sustainable model. I do worry about free services. If I can pay for a service, that $1 for or $2 for unsubscriber or $50 a year for Evernote or whatever. You know, I pay for that because I want that thing to be continually developed and I don't want it to sort of languish and sit back. So,
sure. But yeah, just like the NPR model, though, like it is technically free. It is free for everybody, but some people donate, the people who can, the people who really want to survive, like push it forward. So like, and yeah, in the same way, that's probably the best model to have something. The key with Wikipedia
user
is
they supported,
don't run
is what
ads.
You're saying.
Yeah, user supported.
User
they don't
supported,
run ads.
No ads.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the Wikipedia makes money from ads is the interesting part. The Wikimedia Foundation, which is the parent of the Wikipedia, they have their like Wikia site. So like, what's the Star Wars one?
Any sort of niche,
anything.
Yeah, niche interest.
The Star Wars one is like the Wikipedia.
Right,
that's it. The Wikipedia,
the Muppet Wikia,
is the one that you know is StarWarsWikia.org, and that's the one that has like the ads and everything. But you'll get specialized information down to the nuts about every type of Jedi there is. You know, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, and you know they actually hit a milestone in the video game section for Wikia.
Mm-hmm.
They announced like they're I think it's the most trafficked or the biggest video game site on the web, like bigger than IGN.
Wow.
Now, as of this week, so that's like
IGN is a whole nother. They're Britannica themselves.
Yeah. No, there's something. They're like that cheap ghetto Britannica that they try to sell you.
I think that's the World Book. I think
it's an encyclopedia, but it's a paperback.
All
and
right,
it's in the garbage bag.
All right, so we bid adieu to the print version of Encyclopedia Britannica. We're going to take a little break here to talk about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com, and for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I want to recommend this week is called Turing's Cathedral, The Origin of the Digital Universe by George Dyson. Legendary historian and philosopher of science George Dyson vividly recreates the scenes of focused experimentation, incredible mathematical insight, and pure creative genius that gave us computers, digital television, modern genetics, models of stellar evolution, in other words, computer code. This is one of those books, once again, that I'm hoping won't be dry because it feels like it's right down my alley. Like, I love nonfiction books about tech, and especially the origins of tech. And this is right down my alley for that kind of interest.
That's cool.
Everything by the Dysons, too. Like, just read whatever you can, because I don't know what was going on with that family, but they are all geniuses.
We're going to take a little listen to this. It's narrated by Arthur Moray. So here's a little clip from that book.
In 1956, at the age of 3, I was walking home with my father, physicist Freeman Dyson, from his office at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, when I found a broken fan belt lying in the road. I asked my father what it was. "It's a piece of the sun," he said. To an engineer, fan belts exist between the crankshaft and the water pump. To a physicist, fan belts exist briefly in the intervals between stars.
So that was a little clip from Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe by George Dyson. And that book, amongst any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, can be yours for free by going to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for the free audiobook plus the free trial. And going to that site helps us out on the show, so feel free to do that. If you've never signed up with Audible before, use our code. Do it here for the Drill Down. All right, so we're going to take a little break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk about a feud. Not a feud, really, but more like a...
It's a new front in the IP wars.
Yes.
An angry troll. That's what I'm calling it.
Yes. It's a new front in the IP wars. It's a global war.
The new old front, right? Yeah,
exactly. A new patent war on the horizon that has gotten a lot of people upset, and probably for good reason. So take a listen to this and come on back.
I heard you on the wireless back in 52, lying awake intently tuning in on you. If I was young, it didn't stop you coming through.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down, live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Devinder Hardawar, Dwayne DeFreitas, and Christopher Bernard is out this week. And let's talk about this this lawsuit, this patent lawsuit that Yahoo is plying against Facebook in what is either the boldest gamble of its history or the most boneheaded. Yahoo has filed a massive patent infringement lawsuit against Facebook, which includes, Yahoo alleges, Facebook's popular news feed, advertising methods, privacy settings, and more. Yahoo adds that Facebook has been free riding on Yahoo's intellectual property and that royalty payments alone will not suffice, that they want triple damages and to enjoin Facebook from operating by using said patents. The timing could not be worse for Facebook since it's in a quiet period before its upcoming IPO. Yahoo's done this kind of thing before, having wrangled with Google until right before Google went public in 2004. Mm-hmm. And basically, this is a shakedown. Yahoo is shaking down Facebook because Yahoo does not have a working business model really anymore.
I think somebody listened to that This American Life episode and they were like, huh, yeah. That sounds like a good idea. Let's be patent trolls. Why don't we?
So, yeah, I mean, this is well, okay, so Yahoo got a new CEO. How many weeks ago? Like, what, 6 weeks ago or so?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the board brings in these new people to make the board richer. And they're gonna do, like, whatever they think they need to do to make that failing stock price go up. And when they do their risk analysis based on, like, how's the brand going to look with the PR,
yeah,
how much money is out there for us, how much is it going to cost us to litigate this thing. Suppose it cost them $20 million to litigate this particular case and any case associated with it. The yield is, hopefully they're going to settle. It's not going to go to court. Hopefully that's what they're thinking. And the yield is something akin to the Microsoft Android agreement where they just get paid for having had that patent first. And I think that's like the business purpose behind these kinds of things. It is leechy. It is stupid. It calls into question what we should be patenting, because let's face it, Yahoo's so old that these ideas were in fact new ideas to judges and patent attorneys and patent clerks and all the people involved in that system. So these ideas were new. We took them for rote and, like, you know, just part of whatever. And, you know, Facebook and everybody else in the world that has any kind of website, you know, found new and different ways to exploit these uses in order to, like, you know, have, like, viable good products. And the sad thing here is that the reason Facebook got sued is the same reason Google got sued by Viacom the minute they bought YouTube, because they're the big fish. And once they can settle with the big fish or get some kind of decision on the big fish, they can go after all the little fish. You know, it's just what it is. So. Yeah. It's a sad thing to see a company that was so venerable for so long, you know, go down such a weird road.
What's really funny is that I guess, like, clearly none of the Yahoo higher-ups care what anybody thinks about them. Like, they are just so hated now. They're like, you know what? Let's just do this, because the worst thing that can happen is that, you know, we lose more respect, which we barely have any right now, you know? Uh-huh. So, like, and in the best case, you know, they make some money, which they really, really need.
Yeah.
So, but say they do settle and Yahoo gets a payout from all this. What next for Yahoo? Are they going to move on to somebody else?
I think Yahoo wants to do two things. They don't want just a payout unless it's a huge one.
Mm-hmm.
They probably want a license fee.
Oh yeah. So everybody wants licenses now.
Yeah, they want an ongoing fee that's going to keep the lights on. And then yes, once that settlement happens, they basically take that fee. And they use it to go after other people. Just like Microsoft takes
precedent.
You have precedent. You take that fee, you go after other people. You take that, just like Microsoft takes that fee and they use it to develop their Windows operating system. It goes right into the budget, you know? So yeah. I think that's what they're going to do. And that's it's to me, what's more interesting is what Facebook's going to do. Right? Because Mark Zuckerberg is like, he's not the kind of guy to take like some shit like this lying down. Right? He's like, what the what?
This sounds like the sequel to the Facebook movie, right? In the lead up to the IPO.
Right.
Yahoo, the big bad, comes out of nowhere with this bullshit.
It's almost like they want to take that IPO down a notch. Right? Like,
no, they
why
want
not
a
just...
piece of that IPO. That's clearly what they want, right?
Sure. Yeah, we who get, doesn't?
Like, in exchange for, like, yeah. in exchange for 2% of your IPO or some shit like that, you know, we'll put this away. But,
right.
yeah.
I mean... To be fair, other companies are making a lot of money from licensing their patents. Like Microsoft is making a crap ton of money from Android manufacturers.
Right.
But I think they've also proven that what Google definitely did take some code from Microsoft that's in Android, and that's their bad, like however this happened. And yeah, it has to be licensed now. This just seems like so general and so broad that nobody can take this seriously.
Yeah, there was a post in TechCrunch outlining the features that Yahoo's suing Facebook for, and how,
oh yeah, it's so funny,
and how those same features appear literally everywhere on the internet in you know for each one of the 10 patents that they're suing, there's 10 other companies that have that those features integrated into their
Let's
site.
Let's take a little read of what these features are. Let's say control for enabling a user to preview display of selected content based on another user's authorization level. Google Plus has that. Customized content feeds, dynamic page generator, authenticated identity, unified messaging, ad sorting, spam detection. Really, Yahoo? Because my Yahoo account, you might be detecting it, but what I mean. Yahoo has gotten so desperate for money that and this is a true story. You talk to a Yahoo rep, not a Yahoo rep, you talk to like someone like an emailer rep, and they'll be like, yeah, so there's this new product coming out that Yahoo's making for us that allows us to get our offers in the inbox. Yahoo's just selling the inbox now. Just selling it. Like content relevance sorting. And here's the kicker. Yahoo is upset because Facebook and other companies have privacy settings.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just so transparent what they're doing. They're not really upset at any of this. They're looking for a payout.
Yeah. Next week, Yahoo sues the internet. That's basically yeah. what's happening. Right.
So it's just sad to see such a great company. You said it, Dwayne, you said it right off the bat. It's sad to see such a venerable company just spiraling down towards,
But when last were they venerable, right? Like, I know you like their fantasy football thing, Dwayne, but when last has Yahoo made something that's made everybody say,
oh,
wow,
we've talked many times about Yahoo, how Yahoo is on it's where technology goes to die in many respects. They and Microsoft have that in common, which was what would have made a great merger between the two of them. But,
Well, no, Microsoft doesn't have, like, Microsoft can actually fulfill, like, a product's, like, for the most part, they've actually haven't been too bad about at least making money and not having everything they touch be a colossal failure.
They got the businesses on the crack and everything, but in the end, like, new techs, you know, with the whole thing with Danger and a couple other things, like, you know, ugh.
Yeah, oh, we talked about that earlier, yeah. Because,
so,
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying here is that, you know, this is clearly, like, it's a new low is what it is. I think you'd agree with. It's a whole new low. You know, like, who's sitting around thinking, how can I get this patent trolling game? You know what I mean? It's a new low. They're just like, how low can you go? You know?
Well, I mean, it's also a symptom of the new CEO, right? Like, clearly he's just sitting there saying, like, what can we do to make some money? Well, we have patents. What can we do with patents? Let's enforce them somehow. And the lawyers go to work. Clearly, they're not thinking about products. So, like, whatever hope you had for Yahoo to, like, revitalize Flickr or anything, or, like, somehow, you know, become a force that actually is relevant in technology again, is gone now because of these things.
You know what I think is interesting is Mark Cuban posted a post in the Huffington Post that said basically that he wants Yahoo to crush Facebook with this suit solely because it will cause people to reevaluate the stupidity of patent laws as they are, and perhaps,
and Facebook would be able to survive it, right? Even if it was a $30 million something, Facebook would be able to survive that. But I mean, granted, but it might be much.
How would that would,
what he's saying is it's so outrageous. If Yahoo were to prevail in any kind of lawsuit,
Sure.
And if the press is out there and saying Yahoo wins, Facebook sucks, the amount of goodwill there is for Facebook, despite all its foibles and problems, the amount of people who rely on it and have confidence in it and think it's a good product, to see some ancient, like, gross Yahoo group go and attack Facebook and make Facebook, you know, have problems, is going to cause so much ruckus.
Yes.
That we're going to have to
reevaluate the patent.
It's the way that's right. What's going on here. Maybe even think to ourselves, you know what, like, this happened 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. We need maybe an expiration. We need to maybe segment. And I mean, this is what everyone's talking about without talking about it. We might need to segment the patent situation and make this idea of software patents, which don't exist, actually exist. You know?
Well, you know, that's certainly a possibility, I guess. It just seems like a weird leap especially for, like, what's going on in the government now. Like, hey guys, campaign reform or campaign finance.
Yeah.
You know, we're in, like, crazy Wild West territory right now where anything goes.
They're
ridiculous.
Like, yeah, so that corporation is actually a live person and be able to express their viewpoint exactly as they should. Therefore, the super PAC can raise $29 million in a weekend, unchecked, unbalanced, and unconfirmed.
So I don't expect anything resembling good sense.
What you're saying is that Supreme Court isn't going it may very well be. This is to Andy's point and the point that he referenced. Mm-hmm. That Supreme Court may actually very much be in favor of letting Facebook get crushed by Yahoo. But the amount of outrage would then lean on Congress people to create laws that change the patent system, because all that the Supreme Court could do is lay this on the foundation of the law that exists. But if the law that exists changes, and this is not based on any kind of fundamental Bill of Rights kind of thing, this is like the U.S. patent and trademark law from, like, I don't know, the year 1700 or 1800 or something like that. So this is the kind of law that can be changed by Congress. This is the kind of law that can be looked at by Congress. If we began looking at it now, it's so convoluted and it's so entrenched, and there's so much business that is makes money off the laws, that I would be 60 before any meaningful reform happened, if at all.
Well, who knows? Maybe something like this. I don't see that it is going anywhere. I don't know that Yahoo has many legs to stand on, but you know what? It's going to be – the problem is it's going to be embroiled in court for years and years and years. So
Zuckerberg's gonna be like, why don't you just suck my dick? I'll let you suck my dick. And that's a favor I can give to you.
And on that note, what a wonderful way to end this conversation.
We need Dave Chappelle to just come in here and, like, end these negotiations, right? that's who Facebook needs right now.
So we're going to take another break here. Now, Devendra, you have to take off, don't you?
That'd be really helpful. I need to do some more writing in cap tonight, so it never ends.
You right.
Just a little. Yeah.
Where can people find your writing when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me writing at venturebeat.com, where I'll be working for tonight as well. And I podcast about movies at slashfilm.com. You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra. Everything else I do is at devendra.org.
Awesomeness. All right. We're going to take a little break here and listen to a little bit of music. But when we come back, we're going to talk about a code of conduct for content aggregators and whether it's really even necessary. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Always give credit where credit is due. If you didn't write it, don't say it's by you. Just copy the credit along with the work, or else you'll come off like an arrogant jerk. Always give credit where credit belongs. We know that you didn't write Beethoven's songs. Pretending you did makes you look like a fool. Unless you're Beethoven, in that case it's cool. transparent system makes cheating unwise. The simplest web search exposes your lies. No one wants their reputation besmirched, which happens to liars when they are web searched. Proper citation will make you a star. It shows that you know that we know who you are. Plagiarization will only harm you. So always give credit where credit is due.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas. Devendra Hardwar had to run off and work. And Christopher Brenor is in a plane over on his way back from South by Southwest. So let's discuss this recent article in the New York Times. As words and articles become digitized over the last 15 years, they begin to float there for the plucking and replication elsewhere. Traditional media organizations have watched as others kidnap their work, not only taking away content, but more and more taking the audiences with them. Practitioners of the New Order heard the complaints and suggested that mainstream media need to quit whining and start competing in a changed world, whether what's yours may not be yours anymore if others find a better way to package it. So where's the line between promoting the good work of others and simply lifting it? Naughty aggregation is analogous to pornography. You know it when you see it. And I'm quoting here from David Carr, his article in the New York Times.
Right. I mean, this is very much related to what we just spoke about Yahoo. This is an intellectual property issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of, I mean, it's unsustainable for people to reblog and rewrite things that have already been done without having a – it's unsustainable in terms of like the investigative journalism capital that needs to go into it. So, I mean, this happens in tech all the time. I'll see someone lead with a story and then 13 other tech blogs, you know, begin citing either the original source or a source on the original source.
Right.
And it's kind of like you're using your Twitter feed to perpetuate, you know, the business. And the word is getting out and people are seeing it. And blogging likes to pretend that it's focused on opinion sometimes. And then it likes to pretend that it's not focused on opinion. But I think even more of an issue than that is the fact that it's the aggregators, the Huffington Posts of the world that
They seem to be the bad – what do you call
the
it?
Bad seed.
Right. The bad
they're
element.
Like the bad apple, maybe. I don't know. It's bad. The Huffington Post is like the quintessential example of, oh, you wrote something. I'm going to take what you wrote, reference it, put a sentence or two about it, and have all these ads on my website that will keep me – and, you know, use a different headline to get clickbait on there. And then that will make it so that I can sell this entire property for X amount of hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right.
And it's kind of like – okay, so where's the value? Like, I go to the Huffington Post. I tried to go to the Huffington Post, and I couldn't find stuff. Now, should people be able to rehash and re-understand? And, I mean, how does the news always work? You know, the broadcast news, whether it's radio or it's TV, they're taken from the New York Times, too. They'll say, hey, according to an article in the New York Times, this thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where this whole curator's code and the blog police, that's where this gets muddy. So, I mean, I would say there's no doubt that, like, just constantly re-copying and pasting and rehashing around and sort of, like, pseudo-plagiarism. It's not plagiarism. They have things to say that are different from what the source article said. All that stuff, that's not necessarily sustainable, but I think there are ways to make it work if there are some controls around it. But the whole curator's code, where does that begin and end? No one went to broadcast journalism and said – hey, look, you got to stop this.
Let's give a little information dump here for people who haven't read the article. So there was a concept that was introduced at South by Southwest this week called the Curator's Code by Maria Popova, who runs Brain Picker site on the internet who runs she's Brain Picker on Twitter, and I think she has a website also, brainpicker.org or something like that, and so that they're suggesting that there be a code attached to every article, like a copyright or like a registration mark, and the code would express that a piece of content came directly from another source, or that it's a hat tip, a nod to a source that inspired that thought. And some people are behind this idea, but for the most part, the blogosphere has come out against this, saying, and I'm going to read a quote here from a Gawker piece on the curator code. About David Carr's article in the New York Times, and it's that it's partly a plan to create a council on ethical blogging and aggregation, but what it's really trying to do is codify how to blog without being a huge prick, guidelines that all decent online writers already know. Give credit to sources of information, link back, don't block quote to a ridiculous degree. Everyone who cares about not being a prick already does these things or tries to do them, and if notified of not doing them, should correct them. The people who don't do these things are either jerks or just run worthless content recycling mills like the Huffington Post.
In other words, for
the writers who care about this issue, such a group is unnecessary. Such codes are unnecessary. For writers who don't care about this issue, actions like this will have no influence. So such a group or a codification of rules is worthless. And there's a more fundamental problem, the sort of top-down, expert-heavy, credential-credulous media structure is exactly what blogging has so brilliantly been destroying for more than a decade. The internet is where the upstarts are on equal footing with the experts. There are few barriers to publication, and there's no need to seek the approval of a committee of elite writers and editors in order to be respected.
So how do you feel about at some of this is that, like, for instance, the Wikipedia shows up. We talked about the Wikipedia earlier today. And when the Wikipedia showed up, anyone could write anything at any time. And then as it grew to nearly 4 million articles in the English language, they realized that they needed to put some sort of controls on this to make it – to ensure that the quality of what they were doing was good. So the Wikipedia put on, you know, lock buttons and star buttons and all these things that showed that, you know, certain people who have this much cred with them could you know, write that article about, like, you know, Whitney Houston's death, God rest her soul, things like that. So it wouldn't just kind of get overrun by people with an agenda or people who were joking around or whatever. Now, blogging is not the Wikipedia. They're both, you know, Web 2.0,
right,
sure.
Right.
But part of what happens when anything gets big is that regulations begin to occur. Why? Some people might say it's because, you know, people are finding different new ways to make money off of an existing existing medium or whatever. But it also happens because as a medium grows into maturity, standards have to be erected in order to have that medium flourish at a sustainable rate.
Sure.
And I think that's part of it. Now, many people would come out and say, this is just regulation, and regulation gets in the way of business and free form and free flow. And the whole reason that blogs have been around and have been so successful is because it's the traditional papers and the old media that's had to deal with this kind of crap. We just write what we want to write when we want to write it. The problem is, as things become only digital, there's kind of room for – and it's an elite. Sure, it's an elite. There's room for an elite to take a lead by dropping things like guidelines. Now, the big thing here is that they're guidelines. The only one who's policing blogs are like the FTC and just making sure that when you have a sponsored blog, you say it's sponsored. Things like that to make sure that consumers know the difference between an advertorial and a real blog entry.
Right.
But I think that when I hear the super defensive writing that happened there, I'm torn a little bit because it's clear that that person is emotionally threatened by the idea that, you know, there might be rules he's not following. And the idea that there's this divide between people who don't care who are assholes and people who do care who are saints is absurd. It falls all over the gamut. It goes to the point where you could be writing in the middle of the night because, you know, you've got some deadline and you forget to source someone. Not because you're an asshole, not because you're stupid, but because you just forgot, you know? But part of the community is such that you get in there and you say, hey, dude, you know, it's clear that you got this from my thing. And someone's like, and oftentimes someone will be like, oh, yeah, let me put that source right in there, you know. So there's a lot more,
sure,
you know, movement in this medium. And I think the guidelines, as long as they're held as just guidelines, shouldn't really present a problem to many people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the idea of, you know, because there are two ideas expressed in that David Carr article, and one was a committee, and the other one was these codes. And as far as the codes go, like I have to say that I very rarely come across an article, and I do a lot of content curation for my hobby, which is, you know, promoting sharing stuff on Reddit and Dig and other social media sites like that. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of curation. I very rarely run into situations where there is no source listed at all. It's usually a via or a source or some sort of link in the article that will link back to the source. People are generally pretty good at it. I will even go
in the sources that you go to. I think that people might be generally very good at it. But the blogging sphere is a lot bigger than some of the blogs that we frequent.
Sure,
it's humongous, and I think there are people out there who don't do it, or the people who do it as an afterthought. And even if these guidelines if they were universally accepted, it wouldn't be enough for people like the New York Times. It wouldn't be enough for people like the Washington Post, who are going to be, and possibly justifiably, upset that their efforts, their unique content reporting is being usurped by these little upstarts and, you know, things like the Huffington Post, which, mm-hmm, you know, does kind of dumb down and destroy news. Because the thing about the Huffington Post that's interesting is that they might have a link to the New York Times, but they kind of summarize the article. They cliff note it all up, you know what
right.
I mean? And people eat that up. So that's definitely something that I think people that these companies wouldn't be satisfied. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean that's a bigger problem in itself, and that's a problem more about how to re-aggregate content as more than how to source it, how to give attribution. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a problem that's bigger and more endemic and more more localized to sites like Huffington Post, where they do throw a sentence or two around a huge block quote and call it a day. You know, at the very least, like I'm looking at Huffington Post right now, and I do see a lot of sources listed in those articles. And so that's not necessarily the problem as much as the fact that the way they package their content, and the fact that it feels to me like source sites are getting upset at the fact that sites like Huffington Post is taking their traffic
have an audience. But in fact, in some cases, they're giving them a wider audience.
Yeah.
Because the people that would go to the Huffington Post may not go to the New York Times natively just to go check it out. They might go to the Huffington Post, see an article from the New York Times or the Washington Post or some other news-making organization, and look at it and say, wow, I want to read that article. And they go to the Times and read it and see that advertising. Right. I really think that the only way those organizations are ever going to be happy is if they're getting some sort of kickback, some sort of affiliate kickback for having their stuff.
And that'll never
happen.
As
a source of whatever. Well, in this world, the way we do things now, it'll never happen. But who knows? With the way the patent trolls are going, I can see. I bet you, dollars to donuts that there's a crack squad at the New York Times of lawyers sitting down and trying to figure out how to become copyright trolls.
Well, see, that's why a lot of sites do the paywall thing, because they want you to, you know, pay for the access to the information.
Yeah, and it's a catch for me too, right? Because
right.
Suppose I'm super website A and I have a paywall, and you know, a blogger has paid my thing because he figures it's an investment because he's gonna reblog stuff. So he goes and reblogs what I do. He goes and he's read my story and he finds a way to say anything in a way that his audience might like better. So he goes and he reblogs that. Then his audience looks at his article and go, wow, I want to learn more. And they click and they land on my paywall.
Yeah.
Since they can't read my content, a couple things are going to happen. One, they may be annoyed at how snooty I am to have a paywall up, and then my brand might get diminished. Two, they're not looking at my articles, so they're just going to continue to go to that blog, and they're never going to come back to my site because it's blocked. Three, had I had my site open and had advertisements on my site, I might have gotten some advertising revenue from that onlooker. I didn't get that, and I didn't get the advertising revenue, and I got a lot of negative sentiment because I had the paywall up. I have to judge that against whether or not the paywall is making me so much money that these incremental individuals that may not have come to my site before have ever seen it. So it's really a catch-22. So it's kind of a mess. I don't really have an answer, a solution, and I'm kind of annoyed that it's not so easy to solve. But this is the way the world is right now, yes. So it's kind of weird.
Yes. Shall we wrap this show up? Are we done here?
Yeah, I think we're good. Right. Yeah.
All right. Dwayne, where can we find you on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me at gplus.to/DwayneD, DWAYNED, twitter.com/DwayneD, and flavors.me/DwayneD. So.
All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or gplus.to/MrBabyMan. You know, honestly, just Google MrBabyMan and, that's usually me. So you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Go to geeksofdoom.com and check us out on the right-hand side sidebar is where all the podcasts live, and you can subscribe to our iTunes feed from there. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Sign up at j.mp/subus if you want to get SMS alerts when the Drill Down goes live. If you get an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you have a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on thedrilldown.com. You can let us help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful The Drill Down audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.